All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John, along with my co-host, who happens to be on the road. But his dedication is such, ladies and gentlemen, that he has always said to me, we are not skipping any episodes. We are doing them. The nation needs these libertarian and freedom-leaning insights. So to that extent, here he is.
That might be an oversell, but it is true that we hate to cancel.
Yes, absolutely. All right, before we start, you are catching this podcast on Grumblings Media, grumblingsmedia.com. Also, check us out on all your favorite platforms, whether they're video on YouTube, Rumble, Facebook, or X. Or you could listen to us only. If you're driving in the car, it's a great thing. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, Pandora, basically anywhere podcasts can be found. So go ahead and check us out. All right, Mike, let's get right into it. One of the things that I like to complain about is the central planning of economies. Now, to people who love freedom, Mike, this might be, as Milton Friedman said, you can't have real freedom until you have economic freedom, the ability to voluntarily trade, to enter into agreements that are first and foremost self-beneficial, and in doing so, of benefit to society as a whole. Having said that, Mike, I have been very concerned about what I view as the increasing central planning of the economy by the Trump administration. Some, in a moment of perhaps hyperbole, might describe it as Marxist-like central planning of the economy. If you're given to hyperbole, not me, of course, but
no,
yeah.
Not you, of course.
Yeah, hyperbole. Not about that at all. What was your cop training? I do not think that this is
Marxist.
That's
right. Sometimes the head gives away with the lip will not.
Right. All right, Mike. So let's kick it off. Let's get into what probably is the one sort of case study that people are saying, hey, whoa, hold on a second. What's going on? Which is that the government acquired a nearly 10% stake, non-voting shares, in a private company, Intel, one of America's great foundational companies when it comes to the AI, computers, chips. When we think of computing power, we think of Intel. They power a majority of the computers around the world. Now, Mike, talk to me about this, because it's not like Intel was on the brink of collapse, like the banks in 2008, Chrysler.
It's not
was.
A bailout. Required.
It's not a bailout, not like Chrysler. By the way, libertarians would also tell you the government shouldn't bail out companies that are about to fail anyway, but...
No, that's right. We should have let Chrysler go down, but that's a different podcast.
Right. So...
Youngsters, ask your mom what Chrysler was.
Right? Yeah, ask who Lee Iacocca was. But anyway, so here's the thing, Mike. Part of this, though, may be a little bit more than just, hey, the government saw a good investment. A lot of this has to do with backroom dealing, politics, and optics. The major thing that I found a little disturbing is that the CEO of Intel, a Mr. I want to pronounce his name right.
Lip-Bu-Tan.
Lip-Bu-Tan, right, who is Chinese, was being dragged through the mud.
In his defense, Taiwanese. Yes.
Taiwanese. Thank you for the clarification.
I don't mean a cultural distinction, but could become relevant in a few moments.
Yes, and I'm sure it will. President Trump had been dragging him pretty badly on Truth Social, accusing him of several different things, questioning whether Intel really worked for. Was it for the People's Republic, which, to your point, the distinction of Taiwanese versus Chinese becoming important.
So, and Mike, Austin Powers would say, who does number two work for?
Exactly. Who does number two work for? So, Mike, this to me, and tell me what your thoughts are, appears to be strong-arming by the federal government of a private corporation in order to be able to conduct business without having the government consistently looking over its shoulder and sticking its nose in its transactions. Am I right, or am I overstating? How do you see it? Am I overstating
things? No, I think you're spot on. You are spot on. I'm going to do something. You and I did not discuss this before podcast so that I could say the following and you would still let me on. Okay.
Go ahead.
I was afraid if I disclosed what I was going to say, that you would say, no, we're canceling today. as your audience knows, we have tended to be fairly critical of the president, his administration, especially his administration, the fact that I personally feel like he's surrounded by a bunch of goofballs who does not serve his own long-term interests. But that's neither here nor there for the moment. I'm going to stand up for the president's actions here, not so much because I think it's a fantastic idea, but because I think that he and his team have done such a crappy job of selling it. I'm going to sell it and see if our audience is buying it. Okay. Maybe I will fail, but I'm going to give a shot at selling it the way I think that the administration should have at least tried to sell it.
Right.
Because the way that it has come off is exactly the way that you have described. And just a quick background, you know, NVIDIA and AMD and Intel are the three big manufacturers of silicon semiconductor chips, which are so critical to the future development of AI, including, importantly, AI that will be deployed and is already being deployed in a military operational sense.
Sure.
So these chips, which NVIDIA dominates.
Yes.
This is important. Intel and AMD are small, much smaller players. NVIDIA dominates. These chips are critical not only to our future economic development, both in just the sense of growing our economy, but also in a strategic sense, if you believe, as I think most of us do, that AI is going to play a central role in the development of our economy in the future. Very strategic, very important in the long-term development of our economy. And also, potentially, a critical leverage point in our ability to defend ourselves militarily. If you believe, I don't want to get too far into the weeds because we could disagree on this, but if you believe that China is potentially our big military rival, or at the very least, a block of nations led by China could be our future military rival, a block of nations that, say, would be advantaged by Chinese technology in AI, right? That means the availability of these very high-end AI-accelerating semiconductor silicon chips is critical to our defense in the future. And our ability to control who else has access to them could also be important to our defense in the future. And particularly making sure that the Chinese government cannot shut down our access to these chips is potentially critical to our economy, to our strategic objectives that are economic, as well as our strategic objectives that are military in nature. So with that as background, and recognizing that both NVIDIA and Intel are Santa Clara, Silicon Valley, California companies that are publicly traded, diverse ownership. Their biggest shareholders are the large financial institutions that control mutual funds and large institutional investors. Right. We get that. These companies have a lot in common. But NVIDIA, which is the dominant designer of these chips, manufactures the bulk of its chips in Taiwan. Some of us have been saying for years that this is a weakness in our ability to defend ourselves in the future, because the People's Republic of China has explicitly said, they're not hiding the ball here, they have explicitly said that it's a part of their five-year plan to take over Taiwan. If they take over Taiwan, they control the manufacture of chips that are designed by NVIDIA, and therefore control the dominant majority worldwide chip manufacturer. Okay, now, maybe in some world the Chinese government plays nice. They don't tariff us or put duties on these chips or restrict our access to them. They don't implant spyware in the manufacture of these, and everything is hunky-dory, and we have permanent access to these chips on a level playing field and in a cheap fashion. That could happen. Or it might not happen. But the threat of it not happening, the threat of us having our access to these chips choked off, means that our government feels the need, and by our government, I mean the Biden administration, felt the need to say we would go to war to protect Taiwan. Were it not for chips, does anyone think that it would be a good idea to go to war with the People's Republic of China, world's largest army, third largest nuclear arsenal, by certain standards, the leader in missile technology? Does anyone think it would be a good idea to go to war with those people over what is essentially a civil war? No, that's a bad position to be in.
Right.
I think that everyone was shocked when President Biden said that we would go to war with them, including, by the way, fascinatingly, his own administration was shocked. The first time he said it, they walked it back. In essence, they denied that their boss had said it. He said it then two more times, making it increasingly difficult to say he didn't say that. He didn't mean that. And then by like Friday, he was saying, no, I meant it. It made it very awkward, right? Okay, the reason we're in this stupid position is because we need access to these chips that are manufactured, not exclusively, but mostly in Taiwan. What are you going to do about that? There's got to be an answer other than go to war with China, or, you know, we'll just see how it works out and hope the Chinese are nice to us. Those can't be your only two strategies. And I have long said that we need to unwind our dependence on Taiwan, either by squeezing NVIDIA to develop an ability to manufacture these chips elsewhere, which is not easy. We're talking about a decade-long investment timeline. You know, this is not something you can decide, oh, well, you know, we've decided to open a plant in Omaha and it should be, you know, running by March. That's not how this works. Or by getting someone who already manufactures in the United States, someone who rhymes with Wintel, to step up their technology, expand their ability to manufacture, and to leverage the presence that they already have in the United States. Okay, so picking strategy 3B, if strategy A is war, strategy B is prey, strategy C is either squeezing NVIDIA or hoping Intel can step up its U.S. manufacturing, you know, this matters. And that is not to say that that's an excuse to do whatever you want with the private sector company. Everything that you said in your opening monologue is spot on correct, right? There's no escaping any of that. But the background motivation is important, and I believe the administration has not sold any of that whatsoever. So, with that as background, the strategic interest, the fear, the risk, right? Now, you can argue away the fear, you can argue away the risk, but you can't just pretend it's not there, right? You cannot pretend that it's not there. Okay, against all of that backdrop, in the spring of this year, Intel names a new chief executive officer. Now, you might think that someone as smart as the Intel board could read the room, realize that we have an increasingly power-centric, some would say authoritarian, some would say merely populist and activist administration in Washington, who's concerned about access to chips, someone would be able to read that room and say, when we appoint a new CEO, part of his or her job has got to be making nice with the U.S. federal government and right. building that relationship and making sure that as an American company, we don't run afoul of the interests of the American public in terms of defense or sure. strategic economic development. You would imagine a board of directors as sophisticated as Intel would have that conversation before naming a new chief executive.
You would hope.
You put all that into the blender, and what they pour out is their new CEO is a Taiwanese, by culture, Chinese investor with strong ties to the People's Republic of China and the Red Army. By virtue of having made hundreds of millions of dollars off of investments in China with strong ties and continued huge income flow from these companies that are controlled apart or in the main by Chinese institutions. Now, I'm not saying that that per se means it's a bad idea. Like, that doesn't make him an idiot. It doesn't make him right. a jerk. It right. doesn't make him a fool. It doesn't make him a spy. It does mean that you have done a bad job of managing the relationship with the American public, the American economy, and the White House. And those are three institutions of which I would not want to run afoul if I were in the business of manufacturing chips.
Mike, I agree with everything you said, and here's where I'm going to push back a little bit on you. Because while I agree with you, I think of going back to immediately after World War II, through the Red Scare, the Cold War, Vietnam, every conflict the U.S. has been involved in, there have been government contractors, and that has been the preferred quasi-free market way of addressing the situation you've just described, right? Like, for example, without naming company names, I'm a consultant in the real world, right? If I go to consult for a company that does business with the U.S. government, it means extra background checks. It means you have to be a U.S. citizen. It means all your work gets done in the U.S. You can't outsource it. You can't subcontract it, right? These are free market restraints that say, if you want to do business with us, here's what you have to agree to.
Yep.
Why do you think, I mean, we know the answer. Why is the government so quick to jump to, we want 10% of your company? Because if you think about it, it's non-voting yep. shares. They have yep. no seats on the board. It's just we own a 10% stake. And by the way, the guy we were complaining about, Le Boutin, we were complaining about him essentially calling him a spy without calling him a spy. But it all goes away for a 10% piece of your action.
Yep.
Right? So to me, at least on the outside, again, even given all the concerns you've stated.
Yep.
Which I believe there are free market solutions to
yes, yes.
What you just said. Why is it that all this concern goes away just because you're getting a 10% cut? Does it make a sense?
And that's the screw up. In my right. view, the White House has done a bad job of selling it because they cut a crappy deal. In other words, the deal itself may not be so crappy. It's just right. it does a crappy job of aligning with the concerns, addressing the concerns, making the concerns go away. To your point, the CEO of Intel would not pass the background check. He would right. not get security clearance if he were a federal government employee.
Right.
That's all right. You know, requiring a security clearance is a bit of a violation of free market principles, but it's one right. that we have learned or we estimate, we guess, might still be a good idea anyway. Right?
Well, it certainly as compared to direct government ownership of a private institution, because you could, the argument for what you're saying, and again, it's squeezing a company, yep. right? But the answer is you are not required to do business with us. So if you want to do business with us, here's our conditions. I mean, I understand that's sort of backing into a free market. I get it. But at the same time, what we have now is the administration, which is already prone to
yep.
Approaches of more control, more centralization of power.
Yep.
I think this just feeds into it. So I agree with you.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. And that's part of why the administration, in my view, has done a crappy job of selling this,
right.
is it has already undermined its own brand, right?
Right.
In other words, look, one of the brilliant things about Nixon going to China is that he was such an anti-communist hawk, right?
Yes.
So when he goes to China, nobody said, oh, you know, Nixon's getting soft and and he's going to cut a crappy deal, right?
Right.
You've got to build your brand in advance so that when you need the political capital to spend, it's there. And the Trump administration has punted away its political capital in this regard. If, on the other hand, you and I were running the administration, right? Thomas Massie, Rand Paul administration. A libertarian administration that had not done several, let me put this politely, several things already that have veered away from strict adherence to the Constitution, right?
Fair enough.
If you had protected your constitutional brand as an administration up to this point,
right?
Then when you say, here's the exception.
Right.
I'm really worried about military, economic, strategic interests. There's only three manufacturers of these chips. AMD is too small. One is in manufacturing in Taiwan. And the third one just hired a Chinese national as its CEO, and he's got ties to the Red Army, all of which is true. If you say that out loud, I think you get a lot of American support, especially if you don't say it Friday at 5. If you make this case for a month, right,
yeah.
pointing out what the issue is, then cut a deal. And again, you know, I go back to, I've often said, well, for years I've said, we need to unwind our dependence on Taiwan manufacture of chips, right?
Sure.
In that sense, it's not so much a matter of principle, it's a matter of pragmatism. Trump is probably the right guy in the sense that you need a deal-oriented structure for how you deal with this, as opposed to merely a matter of principle. If your whole shtick is anything goes, it's not going to work out, because the one thing we expect of our government is to keep us safe. It's the only thing a libertarian asks of our government is to keep us safe.
Right.
And so if the president had said all of that in a forceful way, I think he would have carried a lot more water. One of the things, you know, you and I were talking earlier about crony capitalism, right?
Right.
And I'm reminded of how we all feel about the military-industrial complex. A set of military contracts, large corporations, plus the RAND Corporation as its research wing, big companies, big arms manufacturers, technology manufacturers, technology developers and providers, companies that keep the military of the United States on top at a huge price. One of the problems that we fear, and Eisenhower is the first to warn us of this in a really vociferous, loud, clear way, what we worry about is that complex of companies having too much influence over the U.S. government, even fostering too much hawkishness and a willingness to go to war. Okay. Isn't this a little bit the opposite of that? In other words, in some sense, if the administration does nothing, don't we open the door? Again, I'm making the case for the administration's actions here in a way that I wish they had, right? I'm trying to show that you could sell this in a better way than they have. If we do nothing, don't we open ourselves up to a grand total of two high-end chip manufacturers, One does business almost exclusively in Taiwan that the Chinese government says it wants to take over. The other one has a chief executive from Taiwan with strong ties to the People's Republic of China and the Red Army. If those are the only two companies that are your big providers, don't you open yourself up to the possibility that these companies in the future exert enormous influence over us strategically?
Sure.
In terms of access, in terms of pricing, in terms of information flow in both directions, that's not a strong hand. And so one might argue, I'm not making this argument, but you'll see where I'm going. What if an administration soon after Eisenhower, say Jack Kennedy, hears these companies are getting too powerful, I need to take the bull by the horns? Whether that means pushing back and restructuring and possibly sunsetting big pieces of the CIA, which got him killed, or exerting influence one way or another over these companies directly, I have to do something about that. I think that that is the positive spin that I would have suggested the Trump administration take in this case, is that we don't want to leave ourselves vulnerable to what is an essentially a duopoly in the control of this very strategic future resource.
You know, Mike, I don't disagree with you entirely. I just disagree on two levels. One is I don't want to beat China only to become China, or becoming China in order to not become China, right?
Right.
So that's the one fear, and that's just philosophical. That's foundational for me. The second one is, to your point, the administration frittering away their political capital by claiming that everything is an emergency, that all the president's actions are due to some emergency that only exists in his head and that only he can quantify, and he's the only one at a level that can understand it. So to move on to the next topic, which kind of blends into this, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, when he's not busy trying to convince us that tariffs are wonderful, he made an interesting declaration yesterday, and he said, listen, I don't like the fact that housing is down. I don't like the fact that Americans can't afford houses. So perhaps after the Labor Day weekend, the president will declare a housing emergency so he can further regulate the market. And he's talking about median home prices being up slightly year over year, that many Americans ever since COVID, especially young Americans, can't afford their first homes. And then, of course, it dovetails into interest rates are too high. Let's fire Jerome Powell. So let's declare this emergency, and then all of a sudden the president gets these alleged sweeping powers. Mike, talk to me about this. Is this a good idea? If it's a good idea, is this the best way to go about it? Much like you're taking a stake in Intel, talk to me about this proposal that a housing emergency be declared.
It's a bad idea on one level, and then on another level, it's a very bad idea. It's just, you know, to your point, is an administrative matter, and what is it that we are turning into? You know, as a matter of philosophy, one might argue as a matter of ethics as well, but let's just keep it to political philosophy. It's a horrific idea. The idea that you would presuppose your own positions as being smarter than the market is horrific as a matter of pragmatism as well as philosophy. If we have learned nothing else over the past century, let it be that Milton Friedman was right, that free markets are the most efficient in terms of running an economy. And it is also true that a free market is the most efficient way to run an industry.
Right.
And injecting yourself into the housing markets is a bad idea. If you do it on the finance side and, you know, you find yourself doing things like creating Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you get things like 2007, 2008.
Right.
because these institutions were a bad idea from the get-go, and they were politically controlled, politically backed, politically protected, and then they failed and brought down the American and international economies right. with them. Outside of that, what could go wrong?
Right, exactly.
So in this case, you know, he's talking about foregoing some tariffs on building materials. Okay. One might be forgiven for saying, if you've noticed that tariffs are a bad idea in this industry, one might turn over another rock and notice that they're a bad idea for other industries as well. In other words, you shouldn't even be positioning it as advantaging housing. Just right. stop disadvantaging housing and all the other industries that rely on imports. In this case, Canadian lumber, but
right.
other industries all over the United States depend on inputs being imported. The other big issue in housing prices, of course, is the extent to which there are local rules about building, right? Zoning right. ordinances, building requirements, all of which should either be abolished or privatized. You know, I don't have a problem with the idea of an inspector. You know, realtors always, their heads explode when they hear me say we need to get rid of the municipality's control over inspections and approving sure. building. And I'm not suggesting that that means that everyone should just stand up whatever they want willy-nilly and everyone should just blindly and potentially subject to fraud buy it. No, I like the idea of inspectors, but as anyone who's ever purchased a house knows, the best inspection you get is the one that you pay for in the private sector, right?
Oh, sure.
These yeah. are typically former contractors who don't come over for free because the town sent them. You need to give them several hundred dollars and don't accept one that says he can do it for $99.95. You know, get the $600 inspector over and tell you what's really going on with that house.
Right. And that goes back into the whole libertarian disdain for licensing, right? It's just the government
Absolutely.
Racket.
Absolutely.
It doesn't, yeah.
So
it doesn't
the mean White that, House yeah. says, you know, they want to reform all of these local rules. You know, I start to put my thumb up. You know, that's starting to sound pretty good. And then he says, in favor of a nationwide building code?
I have to tell you, Mike, when the Treasury Secretary, again, I draw a distinction between what the president says and how he says it, because let's face it, he's an 80-year-old man. He's talked a certain way his entire life. It's not changing now. It's not, if he hasn't learned how to speak publicly up until this point, he's not going to learn. I have.
Nor was he elected to articulate refined statements about building codes.
Exactly. Despite what people think about him being a real estate guy, he doesn't know anything about building codes and rebar strength.
Right.
Of course not. I do get disappointed when the Treasury Secretary comes on and his very professorial, I have to admit, he cuts a very professorial tone. He sits there, yep. he's got the glasses, yep. deep voice and everything.
Yep.
And what spills out of his mouth is a constant disappointment for me, not necessarily on policy, but the fact that he's able to say this stuff with a straight face, where he's like, you know, like where he, like to your point, well, if we declare an emergency, that means we can lift the tariffs that disadvantage the housing industry that, by the way, we imposed to begin with 6 months ago, that, by the way, has been raising so much revenue, we don't want it. And it's just one nonsensical statement after another, as if someone just threw this salad of statements at him, and his job was to try to Mad Libs his way out of it by giving us these ridiculous statements. So
he sounds like an unprepared high school debater.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe that's a better description. You're absolutely right. Like, I mean,
a smart one. You know, you take an A student who's a senior and good at debating, and you say, we just put tariffs on Canadian lumber. Now we're pissed off about housing prices.
Right.
Go.
Right. And for example, he doesn't understand that he is advertising cronyism, if nothing else. He's saying tariffs suck, but if your industry is important enough to the president, which is we've already seen with soybean farmers, for example, and things of that nature, if your industry is politically important enough to the president, we'll cut you a deal. We'll let you fly under the radar.
By the way, how does that make you feel if you're, you know, farming something else? If you're not in housing, you're making, you know, baskets,
right?
And you know you're in trouble because of imports on tariffs on the imports you need, and the president doesn't care about you. You've got to feel pretty low.
Well, you got to feel pretty low, and it makes you wonder, like, what does it take, right? Because supposedly, hey, listen, one of my favorite lines lately is, I was told that if I did not vote for Trump in the last election, that we would have a socialist in the White House. And what I like to say is, you know, they were actually right. I didn't vote for Trump, and there's a socialist in the White House right now. Because that's the effect of these policies. And listen, what's more frustrating is, like, again, when Trump says things like this, I think he actually believes it. I don't value the president's depth of thought on this. But Besant, I know, knows that what's falling out of his mouth is just garbage. It's a lie. And it frustrates me. It frustrates me. Because listen, if he was one of Soros's, like, handpicked disciples, like, if you're a MAGA guy, or MAGA person, I should say, you can't have it both ways. Soros can't be so much of an evil genius that he picks like doofuses for his handpicked successors. But if you admit that whoever Soros has, you know, controlling the country, if you're an anti-Soros guy, and Besant is one of those guys, what happened? Did he have a religious conversion? Did he see the light? I need an explanation there. So for Besant to come out and say this is disturbing on two levels. One is it's just garbage.
Yeah.
Two, again, from the first topic about the intel topic, it again shows a preference of the government for declaring an emergency to consolidate power into the executive.
Yeah,
and Mike,
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And in the case of Besant, you do expect better. To your point, it is okay for an elected official to say housing prices are too high. This sucks. We need to do something about it.
Right.
All you people, I want to see activity. Chop, chop. You know, let's address this crisis. It's okay for an elected official to say that. It's not okay for a finance guy to say, okay, we've decided to manipulate tariffs that I've supported all this time. And then, you know, we're going to start manipulating building codes. If they would sell it on the basis of we're going to fight building codes, how much fun would it be if the Department of Justice said, I'm completely making this up as
sure.
I'm pulling this out of my ear now,
right,
with no forethought. How much fun would it be if the Department of Justice said, we've just hired a new attorney whose sole job it is to shut down building codes nationwide. The first place we're going is to sue the city of San Francisco because we believe that their building codes are unconstitutional. By the way, I believe they would be right about that assertion.
I have to agree with you.
That might be a separate podcast. But how much fun would it be if the Department of Justice actually stood up for our rights?
Right.
They could sell it in terms of housing prices, which is the big effect. But as you and I know, the real basis for it is one of ethics. It is a constitutional matter. You should not be allowing a municipality to decide who can live where based on how much money they have, which is really what it comes down to. And I would be okay with the federal government saying as a constitutional matter. Now, maybe they don't make the argument very well. Maybe it turns out, you know, Mike and John are wrong about the constitutional argument, but this should be adjudicated in court.
And more importantly, it's a fight worth fighting that adheres to what we think are the proper principles of free markets and voluntary.
And does a lot more, parenthetically, does a lot more to lower housing prices than manipulating Canadian lumber tariffs.
Absolutely. And maybe we should get our friend Brian Kaplan in on this one to have a drink, and maybe we could talk about it even further. If you haven't caught his book on this, it's fantastic, his latest book.
I love that idea.
Yeah, and sort of dovetailing on these themes now, we've talked about tariffs in the past, why they're bad ideas, and it's just horrible economic policy, even given your nuances for national security, which, again, some people like Milton Friedman also acknowledge that you might have to do on occasion, but clearly not unilateral. And as if someone were listening to Mike Termott and Big John on this episode, the president's unilateral tariffs that he's been laying on people at haphazard rates across the board, back in May was initially by the trade court ruled, illegal, unconstitutional. This was just affirmed, in the federal circuit 7-4, a week or two ago.
Yep.
Of course, the president and the treasury secretary disagree with this. They vow to appeal to the Supreme Court.
Yep, they will.
The federal circuit ruling says that tariffs can stay in place, and they gave them until October 14th. And if on October 14th, there's been no countermanding order from the Supreme Court, that as of the 14th is when these tariffs have to come down. Now, Mike, there's a lot of economic reasons as to why tariffs should be removed, that you and I should be like, yeah, get rid of them, right?
That's right.
We don't need to go into those, not the least of which has been...
We pounded them in previous podcasts.
Yes, not the least of which, again, has been the constant misrepresentation of statistical evidence that tariffs are costing us jobs, increasing inflation, and reducing the overall GDP.
Yep.
However, in terms of just constitutionality, tariffs, as we've always said, are taxes, which are, of course, theft.
Yep.
Now, but from a legal perspective, they're taxes. And that power rests solely with Congress, not the president.
Yep.
The president has argued, hey, we're in an emergency. We're in an economic emergency. We have been ever since I can remember. Therefore, under emergency powers, I have the right to do whatever I want with tariffs. And even that was ruled to be not sufficient. So, Mike, talk to me. Where do we see this heading, and how do we see this playing out, say, if the Supreme Court either refuses to hear the case or affirms the lower court's ruling?
I think that if you're a tariff, you're feeling really weak in the knees right now. I think the tariffs... Their days may well be numbered.
Right.
And those numbers will go beyond October 14, but I don't think it's going to go on forever. To your point, this is a constitutional issue. They are taxes. The courts have ruled that they are taxes in the past. We did go through some weird stuff with the Obama administration and Obamacare when the fees for not having health insurance either were or were not a tax, depending on what the administration was trying to do, right? Whether it was trying to slide it into budget law or trying to slide it past the 60 vote majority requirement in the Senate, or trying to elude judicial scrutiny. It's not like administrations haven't played fast and loose with the definition of taxes in the past.
Right.
But I think the Supreme Court is going to get this one right, if I had to guess, and rule that they are taxes. Now, whether the Supreme Court rules that the president does not have the authority to declare an emergency, I think is more of a gray area. And this is a real lesson for drafters of federal law. You need to tighten up. I know I'm addressing people that have been dead for 100 years, but in the future, you need to tighten up. You cannot leave language that says, the president wakes up on some random Tuesday on the wrong side of the bed, feels like it's an emergency, says so, and now has plenary power over administering taxes all over the United States. That is not how this should work.
Right.
If the Supreme Court rules that these tariffs can stay in place, it will merely be because the drafting of the legislation was far too loose.
Right.
So we'll see how that goes.
I agree. And to your point, that's always been a complaint, right? It seems like you wonder, going back to the framers, why these laws are so, you know, given that the law hates ambiguity, the fact that all these laws seem to have ambiguous clauses in them is always been mind-boggling to
me. Here's the hard rule, unless the president says there's an emergency.
Right. And even emergency is not defined. See, I would be okay with that if, for example, you had a simple clause that says, if an emergency has been declared, if it's not been voted on by Congress within 30 days, it becomes null and void. Just leave it like that. Have Congress say that within 30 days, Congress has to vote on the validity of the president's emergency, for example.
By the way, if Trump does not get his way regarding tariffs, Congress is not going to be able to help him out because, once again, his staff played it wrong with regard to budget law.
Mm.
If he had said that tariffs were going to be included in the budget law because they are taxes, if he had gone and said, you're right, they're taxes. As taxes, he could have included them in the budget law.
Right.
Being included in the budget law would have meant he only needed 50 senators. But he missed that opportunity because they were so hell-bent on denying the tariffs for taxes.
So
now to get it done would have to be outside of the budget law and would require 60 senators, and that he ain't getting.
Or he has to go back and say, guess what? I was lying earlier. They really are taxes. Because part of the problem is, to your point, it's bad messaging. Because every day, several times a day, on several different platforms, Bessent, Lutnick, and the rest of the Keystone Cops are out there telling us that the U.S. is realizing tariff revenue of $300 billion potentially. And that helps, stupid libertarians like me constantly retweet them saying, correction, tax revenue is about to hit $300 billion. These are taxes on American importers. So that messaging, which has been super consistent since the election, that these are not taxes. This is revenue. This is revenue coming into the United States, which an economist like yourself says, no, it's just coming out of our pockets and going.
It's just going from American citizens to the American government.
Exactly. So
just like all the other taxes.
You're right. So to that extent, they did fumble the ball again by not being transparent, despite their claims, and calling this a tax. All right, Mike, let's wrap this up.
I don't even like the phrase American importers. I prefer Americans who are importers.
Fair enough. Yeah. You're absolutely right. It's a tax born entirely, both directly and indirectly through inflation, by American citizens. There's no doubt about that. All right, to tie this up, let's quickly go through this. As a further sign of what, again, we've been talking about, the constant theme is the economy being centrally planned? Are we moving towards this sort of Marxist style of economic control? The final thing is that President Trump has decided to fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, right? Yeah, Lisa Cook, for cause.
Yep.
Cause, which is the only way he can fire her before her term expires.
Yep.
Now, the cause that the president is citing was the claim, the allegation, that several years ago, before she took office, Lisa Cook committed mortgage fraud. Now, outside of the irony of President Trump firing someone for the allegation of mortgage fraud when he's been found liable for mortgage fraud in 37 cases.
Really similar cases, by the way.
Almost identical, if you were to say it, yeah.
Putting things on your loan application that weren't entirely supportable by the facts.
Right. Two points here, Mike, I want you to quickly talk about. One is just the pure procedural method. They haven't waited for fraud charges to be filed. They haven't waited for civil things. These are all allegations, have not been proven, and she was fired. By the way, Lisa Cook she has not left her post. She is suing the federal government for wrongful termination. That's the first thing. The second thing, again, how concerned are you that this is just a way for the president to take away the independence of the Fed and to implement what he wants, which is lower rates to mask the effects of how tariffs are treating the economy.
I appreciate that. I think that that is the only thing in all of these cases worth worrying about is the independence of the Fed. I don't think that most folks realize how important that is. It is one of the pillars of the American economy. As much as you and I get mad at the Fed, it's because it does from time to time get too politicized.
Right.
Or bad decisions are made by humans that really ought to be controlled by a computer. And in this case, the administration is trying to get the Fed to go away from the direction we're trying to get it to go in. When we say end the Fed, it's because we want it to be depoliticized. The best way to do that is to get rid of it lock, stock, and barrel.
Right.
And to take away its discretion over monetary policy. And again, the best way to do that is to end it lock, stock, and barrel. But even if you don't do that, at the very least, you got to protect it from being politicized and controlled by humans fearful for their job or something else. So the administration is really going in 180 degrees the wrong direction here. Look, the charges are dopey, right? Clearly, someone in Pulte's office decided to go after Lisa Cook. And I think the leading theory is that someone compared her mortgage loan application data to the data in the public disclosure regarding her appointment as a Fed governor, found the discrepancies. I shouldn't say discrepancies. I should say inconsistencies in terms of where she was living. In the same month, she reported two different places as her primary residence in order to get advantage finance terms on two different properties. And then on a third property, she claimed it was her second residence. That would actually make it her third. And then it was immediately rented out. So it does look nasty. I don't really have a problem with dismissing someone who is in a financial regulatory job for having done something wrong that a financial regulator needs to enforce. I get those dots connect. I get that.
Right.
The time to have done this would have been when she was appointed, right? When she was cleared by the Senate, that would have been the time to do this. So this does look as though it is motivated to control the Fed. I don't have any doubt that that's what this is up. Nobody woke up all of a sudden and said, let's make sure the Fed governors, you know, none of them lied on their mortgage applications because their role in enforcing the letter of the law in terms of what you report to a federally insured mortgage making bank, you know, that's what's really critical in this world is to make sure that no one is lying about that. This did not happen, right?
Right.
They were going after these people, hoping that they could get leverage on them in order to intimidate the others and possibly get someone to retire to create another board appointment. This is an unfortunate example because she's on her way out at some point in the distant future and would otherwise be in there for a long time, right? And the president just can't wait to make the appointment in the spring to replace the chairman. He wants more control over this. So that's all really bad stuff. Yes, the irony is interesting that it was what Letitia James had gone after him for, gone after Trump for regarding the reporting of financial information when he was securing financing on these properties. I think the White House has done an excellent job of misleading the public about these properties. He lied about how much his apartment was worth, and not in a way that was just a matter of how much it's, you know, how much it's worth in the New York City market. He lied about how big the damn thing was. That's a tape measure issue, right? And the other issue is that the paperwork did not disclose the fact that Mar-a-Lago, by contract with the county, cannot be broken up into parcels. there is no world in which that property is worth $400 or $500 million, much less the billion that the family claims, because it is legally proscribed in terms of what you can do with the property, right, which is how he got the tax breaks, the zoning breaks, access to financing in the first place. The deal he cut to gain control of Mar-a-Lago specifically said it would be operated under certain rules, and those rules mean the property just ain't worth all that much money. It's right. worth $75 million if you're lucky. None of that was disclosed to the financiers. Having said that, these are the most sophisticated financial institutions in the world.
Right.
Don't tell me some young, enterprising 27-year-old MBA could not have availed him or herself of the required information to figure that out, which is why I think that Letitia James is manufacturing something in this case that should not be manufactured. This never should have gone to court, and I do believe that the court should have thrown out the judgment against him, not just in a numeric sense, but in a fundamentally underlying sense, in the same way that Pulte should not have been going after Fed governors, motivated by politics. It was the wrong thing to do, and we shouldn't allow that to stand. But as they say, here we are.
Right.
And the administration is trying to control the Fed in a way that would be bad for our economy, would be bad for our nation, and they just don't realize it.
They don't realize it. I don't know that it could, again, we'll have to see. It'll probably hit the Supreme Court. How much protection, what the clause for cause means, because it's been interpreted to mean for actions taken while in your position. It's not for, that's what confirmation is for, right? The confirmation process is supposed to say, before you get this job, are you qualified for it?
Is your background what we're looking for?
Is your background what we're looking for? Do you have a clean record, so to speak? Once in there, for cause, to my reading, and again, I'm not a lawyer, means have you been a doofus on the job? Did you do something like, did you take bribes on the job? Did you lie on your resume to the point where you can't add and you're supposed to be handling the economy? Like, that sort of thing is for cause.
That's not, well said.
Right? Not like 10 years ago, I may have fibbed on a mortgage. And if you're MAGA, let me remind you, unless you just say this is a revenge issue, having seen your guy go through this in New York and claiming, to what we've said, correctly targeted for this, you should be against it happening to somebody else, right? We got to stop the tit for tat. And also, my
as a matter of fact, how much political capital? Again, we make up these stories in our head that make us,
right. Crazy
fairy tales. Yeah. Here's, I'm going to tell a fairy tale. How much political capital would the White House garner if it were to say, yeah, someone on our team discovered this about Lisa. Apparently she lied, and that's naughty. We shouldn't have it. And dumped it in the lap of the chairman of the Fed and said, deal with this. We're not going to. We have seen the president wrongfully targeted. We don't like that. We don't believe the politicization of our justice system is appropriate or American or in our long-term interest. We hate it. We hate Letitia James. We believe in Trump, yada, yada, yada. Deal with it. And at that point, it would be tough to be the chairman, right? Because I don't know how you deal with, suspend her for a week. She's going to miss game day for 2 weeks. I don't know what you do.
Or fine her somehow, have her pay back, do something civilly. Or even better yet, politically, Mike, to your point, why not throw it? She was a Biden appointee. Why not throw it back? You throw everything else back at Biden. Why not throw this back at Biden and say, what a horrible job Democrats did researching the background of Lisa Cook. Now we're stuck with her till 2038.
Because now she's vulnerable. What else is in her back? What else in everyone else's background? And we demand the Fed chairman come up with some punishment and make sure that this doesn't happen again. We're out.
Right.
Enormous political capital compared to looking like a goofball yourself doing something that everyone recognizes as a transparent attempt to gain control of the Fed.
Agreed. All right, everyone. Hopefully you've enjoyed this episode of Liberty Lent as we discussed, hey, are we becoming a Marxist economy or not? As always, thanks to my co-host and friend, Mr. Mike Tremont, for breaking it down, showing us the subtleties, the layers involved, as opposed to my bullheaded approach, which is one view and one view only. Until next time, right here on Grumblings Media, grumblingsmedia.com. Join us again next week for another episode of Liberty Lent. Until then, peace, everyone.